what I want to do is three things. I want to suggest that we really follow on what John said Monday night about that theology is really a way of seeing. It's a way of looking at and seeing with a particular perspective. And he outlined for us quite well that biblical perspective that we call the theology of the cross. And I just want to lift up one little thing of what he said and underscore that so that you'll know a little bit where I come from in terms of that, of my understanding of that theology. And it's important for me to underscore this fact that the theology of the cross is primarily, and first of all, a way of seeing how God is at work in the world. And that must be, in my judgment, the place that one starts. If one doesn't start there, then to take the theology of the cross into some kind of discipleship is to turn it into the most radical kind of law that I think probably finally is not helpful. But I think it does lead into a style of discipleship. But it comes from the perspective of the question, where can we find God at work in the world? And John really laid out for us well, I think, those places where we can expect to find him. Then the second thing that I want to do is to share with you some material that it comes from outside the church. It comes from some people who have been doing some thinking about the future and about an assessment of where we are in the world and where we might be less than 20 years from now. And then try in the third section to put those two things together as they impact our life. I'm not going to say very much about the biblical material because that would take far too much time. I think from what I've been able to gather, we are sensitive to the biblical issues that we are called to what John in other places has called a shalom kind of a lifestyle, that we are to take very seriously the first article of the creed as well as the second article, that God is creator and Lord of the creation, and that we are called to fit in appropriately with that creation. That our role, indeed, beginning, I think, in the Genesis, the first creation account, is that our function is to be what Gerhard von Rad calls viceroys or underlords, and that our practice in the world or our place in the world is to serve as a statement about God's lordship. Not our own lordship, but his. Being made in the image of God carries with it the idea that wherever human beings are, there the authority and the presence of God also resides. And I'll just refer you to von Rad's commentary on Genesis for a discussion of what that all means. And then as I read on in the book of Genesis, the second chapter primarily, the discussion of how we are to care for the earth and to care for it as creature among creatures. It's important, I think, for us to notice in the creation accounts that the word for ground and the word for Adam are so very similar, Adam and Adama. And that if you'll notice that second creation account, that Adam is made out of dust of the ground, and then also all of the creatures are also formed by God out of dust of the ground. And there is a solidarity established with us and the whole created order. And of course what happens in Genesis 3 is that we wish to become like God and to take ourselves out of this dependency, this interdependency for which we were created, and in which we find, in fact, our fullness and our wholeness. And then our sin is then that we live in estrangement and alienation and brokenness with the creation. It's kind of interesting that the curses that come in the end of chapter 3 have to do with our relationship with the creation. And they aren't very spiritual. Do you ever think of that? They really aren't very spiritual. But they're what we normally call spiritual. I want to do one little digression on that spiritual business. We use the word spiritual in the most unbiblical ways. The Bible never makes distinctions that we make about spiritual. The way the Bible assumes, what I think the Bible's assumption about spiritual is, that anything that is created by the Spirit of God is spiritual. That's how it gets its name, to be spiritual. And so the creation itself is a spiritual creation. And why we ever got into the terrible dichotomy of worrying about whether we save a person, save their soul, and not worry about their body is also, to me, a fantastic distortion of the biblical witness. Because God made us whole, body and soul. He breathed into this lump of clay the breath of life. That was, and you know, the word for breath, ruah, in the Hebrew is the same word as wind, spirit, that we find in the first chapter of Genesis. He breathes into this lump of clay the breath of life, and that whole thing becomes a living spirit, a living soul, a psuche in the Greek, a whole person. The spirit is what animates, makes us who we are, but it is also the body that makes us who we are. So that's a totality, and it is this totality that it seems to me that God is worried about. And if one could use the image of C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters, I think one of the addendums that would be added was, if we could just get Christians to worry about whether they ought to be primarily concerned about the body or the soul, then we've got them. Then we've got them. Because to emphasize one over against the other is heresy in the biblical sense. God intends to save us in our completeness. Okay, that's enough of a digression. I want to just say a couple of other words. The Bible in the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Testament, it seems to me, provides some of the richest pictures of this wholeness that God provides for us. And it's the biblical word, and again, John has tapes around here on this, the dealing with the concept of shalom and of a communal kind of wholeness in which we as human beings fit in appropriately with our creation. And one of the interesting things, when I look around the Pacific Northwest and have done a little bit of reading and a little bit of physical investigation of the culture of the North Coast Indians, one of the things that I appreciate so very much about them is that they left this land relatively unscarred. And then I drive through places like Kellogg and Wallace, Idaho, and they will never forget that the white man was here. The earth will never forget it. One of the things that I like about Holden is the tailings. There are the tailings. And the reason that I like them is that they are a symbolic and a real understanding of what this place cost the earth, and also of what our presence has cost the earth. And I don't think we can say that we fit in very appropriately as long as we understand some of the brokenness that the tailings imply. All right, now, when we get to the New Testament, for me, the book that has become a major resource in trying to struggle with how I live as a Christian in America in the 20th century is the Gospel of Luke. And I'm not going to get into very much of that because I have, six tapes. I spent 6 weeks, or 6 lessons last summer up here talking about Luke. I've just completed a Bible study in my own congregation that went the whole year, the whole school year, and we got to chapter 19. So I'm not going to attempt it now. But Luke has, as John indicated last night, Luke has 1,140 49 verses, and 165 of those deal with the question of wealth and possession and how we use our material goods. And so Luke, and the debate among biblical scholars is, was Luke written to rich Christians or to poor Christians? I don't think we need to resolve that dilemma to know which of the two, except to say if he were writing to rich Christians, he made Nathan Ferguson look like a piker, I think, in terms of laying the wood to folks. And essentially, Luke says three things about possessions and wealth, and I'll just lay those out and then you can investigate them for yourself. The first thing Luke says about possessions and worldly goods is that they can be terribly seductive. And their seduction comes in that they take us away from trusting God, and that for him that's an ultimate kind of a seduction, that we can have our sense of security someplace other than in the Creator. And probably the best illustration of that, the proof text that I would use, would come from Luke chapter 12, verse 13 and following, the parable of the rich fool. And the one line that I like in this comes in verse 16, which I think sometimes we often overlook. And what the rich man overlooked, I think, is this point. In verse 16, and he told them this parable: the ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. What he had was gift, and he took possession of it, and it seduced him from his trust, and so that finally God comes to him, as we know, and calls the accounting, and then the conclusion, as Luke has it, of the parable: this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. The seductive nature of wealth. Then the next thing that Luke says about wealth is that the ultimate way to deal with wealth is to sell all that you have and give to the poor and lay up treasure in heaven, and follow Jesus Christ. And he is able to say this, I think, in staying in chapter 12, and one of my very favorite verses. In chapter 12 contains both my favorite verse and my least favorite verse in Luke. Mm-hmm. And they're right one after another. My favorite verse is one that even is hymn 476 in our hymnal: "Fear not, little flock." So that in 12:32, Jesus says, "Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." Now, when those ring in our ears, then we can hear my least favorite verse. I haven't been able quite to get that verse into my being in such a way that I can really hear the next verse. After Jesus has said, and the RSV reads, "Fear not, little flock, for it is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom," then comes these words: "Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will not be exhausted, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." I tell my people, unless you've heard 32, you can't worry about 33. And I haven't heard 32 very well yet. And so that's the second thing that Luke says. The ultimate kind of discipleship would be to sell all that we have and give to the poor. And then the third thing that Luke says, and may well be the basis for why one could argue that he's writing to rich Christians and not poor ones, is that he holds up Zacchaeus as an example of how one should use their wealth and possessions. And I can't go into all of that kind of thing, but Zacchaeus is a fascinating text. His name means righteous one. And there's tons of themes out of the book of Luke that focus in the story of Zacchaeus. But essentially what Zacchaeus does, and here's another interesting thing and a point I want to make. I have already talked about how we want to divide persons and the mission of the church between preaching the gospel and serving humankind, and that we always come down on the side of decision for Jesus, making some kind of a faith statement. Luke just won't allow that. Sometimes he will say of people, and the interesting thing is that he says it in 18 one way, and then he says it in 20 another way. In 18 he has somebody come whose faith saves them. Then in 20 he says about Jesus. Now this is on the lips of Jesus. He says to Zacchaeus, or to those around who are in the audience to hear, he says, "Today salvation has come to this house." And Zacchaeus has not said one word of confession. He didn't say the second article of the creed or even the first article of the creed. And so it isn't on the basis of a personal confession in Jesus at all, as we understand it. See, we equate the faith with intellectual assent. And Luke says he just won't allow those divisions. When Jesus comes into Zacchaeus' house to remain, an interesting use of a Greek word, meno, to remain, it's the same word that John uses when the word becomes flesh and tabernacles among us, that when Jesus comes and Zacchaeus responds radically that salvation has come to his house, and then Jesus says, "For he is a son of Abraham," meaning one of the things salvation means for him is that he gets back into the community, which his own actions, his own greed, had separated him from that community. So anyway, what does Zacchaeus do? He loses his mind, and I'm sure the next morning, or even maybe after everybody cleared the house that night, Mrs. Zacchaeus said, "Man, you just lost your mind. The Mercedes is gone at least, or maybe the Cadillac, one of the two. We've lost that. And the summer home out on the lake that we built to use, that's gone too." Because what is it Zacchaeus does? He gets up and he makes this proclamation in 19. Chapter 19, verses 1 to 10 with Zacchaeus. He says, "But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord," that's interesting, "to the Lord, 'Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor.'" That's how come the Mercedes, we just handed it over. And the interesting thing is that we can find both in the Old Testament and intertestamental period Judaism demand for the highest demand to give possessions to the poor is 20%, two tithes. Zacchaeus does that 2.5 times better. Now, that would be enough, one would think, right? I mean, if they cut my stuff right down the hill, I'd say enough. That's the practice, in essence, of charity. But with the other half, Zacchaeus practices justice, at least on a personal level, because what does he say? "If I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." And can you see the line forming at the office in the morning? But and that, incidentally, is both in biblical and in intertestamental period Judaism, the fourfold restoration is found there, hints of it, and also in the Greco-Roman world. So he is practicing what, you know, that's not an outlandish kind of thing, that demand for fourfold restoration. But the point is that in the use of his wealth, Zacchaeus has become rich toward God. Now, the reason, and I want to, this is the last thing I want to say about Luke, and this whole question of how one uses possessions. I think we have to ask ourselves the question, why is it that the New Testament and Old Testament and Jesus tie the use of what we have with salvation? Did you ever stop to think about why it is that he won't leave that alone? And for me, the answer to that comes in the sixth chapter of Luke. And I want to say also, one thing about the Zacchaeus text. There's one other passage that immediately follows Zacchaeus that deals with the use of talents. And that's the last word in Luke's gospel about that Jesus speaks about the use of possessions. Now, that's the bookend on that subject. The bookend at the beginning of the subject is when the people come to John the Baptist. And there's a whole group of people come to John the Baptist. Crowds, tax collectors, and soldiers. And if you go back and look at what John the Baptist is telling them, he says, what you must do to escape the coming judgment is practice the fruits that or bear the fruits that bear or that befit repentance. And so to the crowds he says, if somebody has two tunics, or let him give to him who has none, and the same with your food. That's half of your goods to the poor. And then the soldiers come and the tax collectors, and he says to the tax collectors, collect no more than is coming to you, and to the soldiers, be content with your wages and don't defraud anybody. I think the Zacchaeus text answers, Zacchaeus is one who lives bearing the fruits that befit repentance. Now, that talents text, and the reason I bring that in is the last word that Jesus says about the use of possessions is that that the one who has only one talent hides that away. And then when the accounting comes, he says, I knew that you were a hard man. And so I used the possessions in accordance with my understanding of the master. And the guy says, you thought I was a hard man, right? Well, here's proof of it. Zapple. He gets everything taken away and thrown out of any kind of stewardship. The implication is that those who use the talents use them in a concept of the generosity of the owner. Now here's where we come back to the tie-in in chapter 6, beginning in beginning in verse 27, the whole section that runs through then the end of the chapter. It's interesting. Here's what Jesus requires in the Sermon on the Mount, or the plain as it is here. But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. And interestingly, if you read this passage in the light of the passion of Jesus, as it's reflected in Luke's gospel, you will see Jesus doing all that he requires. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. And you can hear Jesus, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. If anyone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. Soldiers smiting Jesus. If anyone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. And they strip him of his clothes. Okay, then when you get down into verse 32 and following, he said, well, we'll do the whole thing. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. That's no big deal, folks. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. Now this material is all shared between Luke and Matthew. Now comes a unique Lucan statement. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even Seattle First National Bank does that. Right? So that's no big deal. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Now here's the reason. Here's why Christians are called to practice generosity, justice. Then your reward will be great, and you will be sons, and we would say daughters, of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. And we ought to say thank God for that, because I think we're peopled in there someplace among the ungrateful and the wicked. And then verse 36, be merciful even as your Father is merciful. Matthew's reading of that says, be perfect even as your Father is perfect. But Luke records Jesus as saying, be merciful even as your Father is merciful. Yesterday we were talking about the theological paradigm about why we care for the poor even when they don't deserve it. Because the Father is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. And we are called to be merciful, even as the Father is merciful. Okay, a lot of more stuff we could say.
It's interesting, in RSV, instead of wicked, it says self-selfish.
Okay, all right. That one would even fit our case better, right? So use RSV at that point. All right. Now, that should establish some kind of biblical injunction. One of the things that we need now to do is to see in terms of what kind of a world we live in. And we've been in a long discussion of that. And one of the differences that I think we have to struggle with is the translation of that biblical witness out of first century, basically an agrarian, much more... limited transportation kind of world to the kind of world that we live in, in which systems are probably no more nor no less oppressive in degree, but in terms of scale, they're enormously more complex and I think have both the potential for good and evil. And we live in a unique time in the history of the world. And everybody who ever lived before us has always said we lived in a unique time in the history of the world, but ours is. Because never before has humankind had so much energy, and I use that in its generic sense, at its disposal. And never before has there been such unbelievable acceleration of the use of resources, of population increases. If you look at all of the graphs about, let's say, population growth, there has been throughout the history of humankind gradual, arithmetic kinds of growth. And in the last 200 years, and even particularly in this century, the growth has been exponential and geometric. And when you lay those graphs down, regardless of what they are, consumption of resources, just everything, the graphs just go gradually, and then there's this sudden spike. That's unique in the history of the world. And so we live in a unique time. And it's a time in which you can play several kinds of games. You can play the kind of a game in which you have ultimate despair. And the way that I see a lot of Christians playing that is playing it with Hal Lindsey and with some people that I've talked to after we've given these kind of presentations. And they say, well, what we really ought to be doing is praying for the Lord's return so that this stuff doesn't have to happen. That's a religious cop-out. And then there is the kind of a cop-out, which I believe it to be a cop-out, and I see it exemplified in Ronald Reagan's speech to the graduates at Notre Dame, in which he says, don't listen to the doomsayers. I didn't know that he read them, but evidently he does. And so we don't pay any attention to them at all. Not thinking that maybe, like the prophet Jonah, the doomsayers come in order that what they have to say might not have to happen, but to call us to see the world in new ways. I don't believe that there's a doomsayer among us who wants what they are predicting to happen. But what they're trying to do is to say, gang, we got to wake up. And then I think the option that I'd like to see us exercise is to say, it's serious, gang. I mean, it is real serious. It appears that we are almost helpless and hopeless over against that, but there is a way to help and there is a way to hope. And that comes in a faithfulness to our biblical traditions. Now, there are lots of people that you can read for what's going to happen. And I recommend that you read both sides of the argument. You can use the one that was mentioned in the Mobil Oil ad that we read yesterday during the first film slip, in which they quote the Hudson Institute and Herbert Kahn, who is the optimist about what's going to happen. And then you can read other things like the Club of Rome reports, or for me, what has become really a central kind of a thing is called the Global 2000 Report to the President, Entering the 21st Century. It is in three volumes, this study. This is the summary volume. And it's available from the government printing office. You can buy them in Seattle at the government bookstore. This costs $3.50. This is the technical manual that on which this summary is based. This costs $13. And it's not something that you would read for bedtime reading, but it is absolutely fascinating stuff. Absolutely fascinating. There is a third volume, which the Seattle office has not yet had, which probably wouldn't do me any good anyway, because it's the model. It tells how the computer model was developed and what, you know, how they programmed it. Now, what Jimmy Carter asked for, this on the 23rd of May, 1977, he did something that very few people, I suppose, took note of, and that is that he commissioned a study, which is the Global 2000 Report to the President. Never before in the history of the federal government had anybody said, now what, as the Department of Agriculture looks at the future, what are its assumptions? What is it looking at? As the Department of Commerce looks at the future and makes their assumptions for government planning, what are they thinking about? As the State Department looks at the future, and they do look at the future, gang, they are watching populations, and they got, you know, I have some friends that are CIA agents. They aren't spooks, as they say in the trade. They're think tank folks, and they sit around and read all kinds of material. The Russians tell us, just like we tell them, just about everything you need to know in newspapers, and even though there's a censored, you know, what their birth rate is and all kinds of things. And so anyway, they do that kind of planning, but nobody had ever said, now what are we thinking about together? What are our projections for the year 2000? So this report pulls these together. When they got finished with this report, they went to the other reports, some of them done by the United Nations, some of them done independently by the Club of Rome, and they linked these up and they said, now here were our assumptions, how do they match these others? And then they did one other thing. They said, you know, one of the things we did not do in this report was that we didn't say, we didn't connect up certain kinds of things that if we connect them, we know that they will affect one another. In other words, when they looked at, let's say, coal production, they didn't say, well, when we're digging up all that coal, we're going to lose X number of acres of farmland. So when they start putting all these connections together, they say that this report is between 15 and 20% too optimistic. Now that'll really make you pessimistic when you find out they think they're overly optimistic. Let me just read some from this report. And the implications of it are staggering, I think. If present trends continue, and they're talking about trends, these are not predictions, they are projections. They just say if you take a look at the way things are going now, and you assume, you know, some changes you have to assume, but not major, you know, just looking at the way population growth is going, where will we be? If present trends continue, the world in 2000 will be more crowded, more polluted, less stable ecologically, and more vulnerable to disruption than the world we live in now. Serious stresses involving population, resources, and environment are clearly visible ahead. Despite greater material output, the world's people will be poorer in many ways than they are today. For hundreds of millions of the desperately poor, the outlook for food and other necessities of life will be no better. For many, it will be worse. Barring revolutionary advances in technology, life for most people on Earth will be more precarious in 2000 than it is now, unless the nations of the world act decisively to alter current trends. This, in essence, is the picture emerging from the U.S. government's projections of probable changes in world population, resources, and environment by the end of the century, as presented in the Global 2000 report. And then I want to say a couple words about principal findings. Rapid growth in world population will hardly be altered by 2000. The world's population will grow from 4 billion in 1975 to 6.35 billion in 2000, an increase of more than 50%. The rate of growth will slow only marginally, from 1.8% a year to 1.7%. In terms of sheer numbers, population will be growing in 2000 will be growing faster in 2000 than it is today, with 100 million people added each year compared with 75 million in 1975. 90% of this growth will occur in the poorest countries. Then they go on to talk about the economic growth of these and the per capita income. There's going to be slightly some increases in the lesser developed nations, but you know, they're so far behind now that even though they will be increasing more percentage more rapidly than us, they'll never keep up. And you can figure that out. Next, arable land will increase only 4% by 2000, so that most of the increased output of food will have to come from higher yields. Most of the elements that now contribute to higher yields, fertilizer, pesticides, power for irrigation, and fuel for machinery, depend heavily on oil and gas. During the 1990s, world oil production will approach geological estimates of maximum production capacity, even with rapidly increasing petroleum prices. The study predicts that the richer industrialized nations will be able to command enough oil and other commercial energy supplies to meet rising demands through 1990. With the expected price increases, many less developed countries will have increasing difficulties meeting energy needs. For the one quarter of humankind that depends primarily on wood for fuel, the outlook is bleak. Needs for fuel wood will exceed available supplies by about 25% by the turn of the century. They go on to talk about deforestation. We are losing enough forests in the world right now to cover the state of half of the state of California a year. If California were covered by trees, we lose half of it every year in the world. Now, we in the industrialized world are not losing our forests like that. We've stabilized the loss of forests. And it's in the lesser developed nations that they're stripping their forests. And this has all kinds of implications, because as soon as you strip the forest, the land can't hold the water as well anymore, so it erodes. It's less productive. Your natural catch basins are gone. Another thing that happens is that once it gets impractical to get firewood to heat yourself with and to cook with, then you turn to vegetable matter and animal dung as fuel. Prior to this time, that kind of stuff had been natural fertilizers, composting, if you will. And so they're not returning that to the soil, so the soil becomes even less productive. Now, in some places in the Sahel in Africa, for a family to heat itself, and when they need heat and to cook their food, they spend 360 person work days a year gathering wood. One person in the family gets 5 days off a year from collecting wood to cook their food with. Now, what role do we play in that? As fossil fuels have become more expensive, they have turned increasingly to wood, because the fossil fuels becoming more expensive go to nations that have the capital, the rubles, the dollars, the marks, the francs, the pounds, to buy oil. So that when we cruise up and down Maine, or like my daughter, who's now almost 17, likes to go down and do the Renton Loop, that loop reaches around the world. Now, I'll blame her, because I never use gas inappropriately. But it has implications. We are in a we are inexorably tied to one another in this globe, and what we do matters, and it has, you know, it has effects around the world, and we need to get that kind of global perspective. I was listening one night as we were driving an extra mile out of the way so that Stephen, after one of his basketball games, could buy a big gulp down at the 7-Eleven. I was listening to a talk show. It just happened to be on, and they were talking about whether someone has the right to buy a big muscle car that gets 10 miles to the gallon. Now, the consensus of the people on the talk show was this: as long as they can afford it, they have a right to do that. It seems to me what we're talking about is to gain a biblical perspective that says, no, they don't have a right just because they think they can afford it. Now, if we're not concerned about the people in the other parts of the world, and let's just assume that they don't even exist, let's just write them off, we have to ask ourselves, what kind of a world do we want to give our children? I believe that we are now in a situation in which our grandchildren have more to fear from us than they have from any enemies that they will have in their lifetime. We did very well by our grandparents. They left us a fairly decent earth. And certainly from our great-great-great-grandparents, they left us a magnificent earth. And we will not leave the same earth to our children and our grandchildren. In the lives of most of us who sit in this room, and certainly in the lives of the infants who are in this room, most of the essential, non-renewable mineral resources on the face of this earth will be depleted. I mean, if you just want to look at these charts, if you want to look at the charts that assume that we would have a static level of consumption from the year 1976, you just can't imagine the kind of things you run out of before our lifetime is out. And then you have to crank in the equation of the increasing amounts of use of these resources. And then they get even shorter. Okay, we can burn wood, right? Or we could burn coal. Well, that has all kinds of implications. I already have alluded to them before. There are lakes, and I hate to report this, but there are lakes in the Holy Land of Norway that have no fish in them because of acid rains. Yeah, well, we just want to deal with the Holy Land now. But we'll get to Wisconsin. And it's interesting that these are lakes that are not limestone. That's how come the eastern part of the United States is in worse shape than the western part, because of the granite that's on the basis of those lakes does not neutralize the acid. So there's a lot of them in the eastern part of the United States that has no way of nature dealing with the wounding that we're doing. And the burning of wood, and interestingly, Corningware claims to have a technology now that will help. It's a catalytic converter that you put in wood furnaces and stoves that will help to deal with some of the precipitate matter and the carbon dioxide and etc. that's emitted to the air that then becomes acid rain. But anyway, the point is, and like our coal-fired furnaces and all of that produce enormous amounts of material that turn into acid rain. And so we put it up here and Norway gets it. Or we put it up here and Wisconsin gets it, because that's the prevailing winds. The other interesting thing about burning wood and taking the forest, even though the forest cover about one-third of the surface of the earth at the present time, they provide two-thirds of the oxygen that's necessary to oxygenate the world.